So the section we're looking at is part three of the Catechism, Life in Christ. That's its overall topic. And section one is the human vocation, life in the Spirit. Section two will be the Ten Commandments, which is for next year. So, human vocation, life in the Spirit. Chapter one, we have already completed now. And it was on us being in the image of God. Our vocation is towards beatitude, communion with God, that is the perfect happiness of the human spirit. Freedom and morality, very general term, but we did all that in lecture 28. Then in the last three lectures we've looked at conscience, then virtue, then sin. Today, chapter two we move to, which is on the human community, looking at it from the point of view of moral behaviour. Good human reactions among each other. And that's our topic for today. Next week we'll look at chapter 3, which is on God's salvation, law and grace. So that puts you in the setting. Let's begin now. It's impossible, obviously, in one moment, one lecture, to summarise adequately the rich and broad teaching of the Church in relation to justice in the social sphere. A fine summary has been made, which I've got a copy of here for you to look at during the break, by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, called A Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church. It's got 420 pages in it, and 100 of them are indexed. So it's a well-indexed book on any topic you're interested in, and you can find a summary there. We've been going through it, or have completed going through it, in our Justice Committee in our own parish, chapter by chapter or section by section. Having gone through it absolutely thoroughly, it's a difficult book, really. It can only be a reference book, because when it gets onto any particular topic, it has wonderful references to the encyclicals of the Pope, Vatican Councils, statements that have come out, all of which are very rich. But it's a bit like a committee. You know, if you have 40 rich statements and someone summarises them and puts them on a bit of, what do they call that stuff, paper at the back? Butcher's paper or something. The summary might say something to the people who are in the group, but to everyone else it's kind of bland and it's reduced back to the... So it's a complex thing. So it's a good reference book, a good index book, a good place to go to be redirected then to more useful, I think, statements. But I do have a list here just for you, just to read. And this is all on the web, or will be by tonight, please God. These are some of the most authoritative statements that have come on this issue, and they're extraordinarily rich. It's one of the secrets of the Catholic Church, really, this wonderful philosophical view of the world and social interaction, and we should be studying it more and living it more as a community. I'll read them to you. Pope Leo XIII, 1891, Rerum Novarum, on the condition of labour. Then Pope Pius the 11th, Quadragesimo Anno, which means 40th year. It was written in 1931, and that's 40 years after. So they kind of all take their springboard from Rerum Novarum. And he wrote that. Then in Pope John the 23rd wrote Christianity and Social Progress in 1961. Vatican II, Gaudium et Spes, beautiful doctrine, you'd know. Vatican II, the religious freedom, is very pertinent to this topic. And then Paul VI, on the development of peoples, maybe the best of them all, I don't know. And John Paul II was always writing on this matter and writing quite brilliantly. On human work in 1981, on social concerns in 1987, and then Centesimus Annus, which means 100 years, in 1991, on the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. There'd be other stuff since then, but these would be the top-level teaching on this area that I'm going to cover with you in just one session. Article 1 is the person and society. In society, we are called to show forth the image of God, in other words, to live in love as a community of persons. And here's the point I referred to just earlier in our conversation. Bernard Lonergan has this most important statement that I think has to be locked into our consciousness to get the right perspective. And he says this in an article he wrote on, or a book on philosophy of God and theology. He says, because it can be a bit of a surprise, and in the modern world, I think it would come as a surprise, our individualistic world, which accents my rights, my opinion, my freedom, you know, my very self-focused world we're in a way. Well, Lonergan gets rid of it in one sentence. He says, the person doesn't come first. What comes first is the community. Because it's within community, through the way persons relate, that the individual person emerges. Since persons are the product of community, the fruit of it, and since the strongest and best of communities is based on love, religious experience and the emergence of personality go hand in hand. I just think that's quite simple and quite brilliant. And all you've got to do is reflect on your own life and think of how important the home is. The little child is born into this home full of every ambition and feeling and possibility of directions in their life. And the mum and dad loving each other doesn't always work. Not every family has that for a whole lot of reasons of health and psychology and all the rest of it. So, but if we can be as a little child able to see love happening between two adults whom we need and admire and depend on and who think we're just the marvellous thing that's come out of whatever, if we've got that environment and we're being trained by them in love, trained to relate to persons beautifully and not just from our own little selfish point of view, well, you will look, if you had that gift, you will look back on it with immense gratitude, won't you? Because it freed you from yourself, from a lot of things in you and other, to grow into the person that you've become. And we're struggling and we're on a journey and we're still there. And if you didn't have that as a child, you can still get it in a primary school from sister somebody whom you really admired and who liberated you, or you come to a parish when you're 70 and you can still, it's never too late, or you can be the thief on the cross and have this beautiful Jesus say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise. It's never too late to, but it's harder the older you get, I think, isn't it? So we've got to try to start when the little child is young, and we all know that. But the point I'm making, which he's making, is that what is primary is community, because it's only in community, in relationship, that I find who I am. You look into the other person's eyes and they tell you who you are. And you'll know this anyhow. People know us a lot better than we know ourselves. Especially in a world where a lot of people, if you're free from this, I'm so happy for you, but a lot of people tend to put themselves down rather than up. I think that's a pretty normal thing. You know, I'm whatever. People, and self-image isn't often very good. It's less than it ought to be. So if that's the case, we need people to tell us who we are. And actually, we need to believe them if they're trustworthy and they're not flattering us, and which is why flattery is such a bad thing, isn't it? And I have to say I see it reasonably frequently, in my judgment, that's all. I see people saying, oh, that was terrific, when it wasn't terrific. So what do you say when it is terrific? You see, so you kind of lose it. Somehow we have to be really straight with each other, honest with each other, and encourage each other, but don't overstate the praise. You'll have your own opinion on all that. But it's vital to be loved and to be in a loving community. So this topic that we're talking about is obviously therefore quite important. Here's the Catechism, number 1882, has... There is a natural tendency for human beings to associate with one another, that's no news, for the sake of attaining objectives that exceed individual capacities. I belong to a religious order which has a mission. Well, what I can't do, the others can do. We can do it together, you see, and well, isn't everything about this? Government's about this, the army's about this, and we there's a lot we can't do on our own, and we want to do it with others. But here... number 1883 says, socialisation, and you just think about this for yourself, this is the catechism, also presents dangers. Excessive intervention by the state can threaten personal freedom and initiative. The most obvious example of that I know is the communist system, which, thank God, has collapsed. Excessive intervention by the state can threaten personal freedom and initiative. The teaching of the Church has elaborated the principle of subsidiarity. So important. According to which, quote, and now he's quoting from Pope John Paul II in that document that's referred to there, according to which a community of a higher order should not interfere in the internal life of a community of a lower order. Lower doesn't mean in importance, but in size, you know. Depriving the latter of its functions. So the state shouldn't interfere in family life, for example. Rather, it should support it in case of need and help to coordinate its activities with the activities of the rest of society. So Big Brother doesn't move into an Aboriginal settlement and tell them the best way they can live. Big Brother might have finances and medical possibilities to go in and serve the local Aboriginal community or the local European community or any community and or the local church community. They might be able to assist it to achieve, because if the family and the local community is thriving and alive and free and has initiative, if the orchestra has every instrument in it playing absolutely superbly in community, well, it's a great sound and it will attract and it'll create the initiative, which will definitely help the state, won't it? Because you've got human beings contributing there. So it's for all of our benefit to support, but not to take over what a smaller community can do. That's the point of this. Everything is in view of the common good. Catechism goes on, this is not a quote, but you'll see the numbers there. Since God is love, and so respects the freedom of persons and the freedom of the universe, now I'll put that in brackets, and it's just a throwaway line, but it's absolutely vital, because just about everyone, I don't say for you, but just about everybody I know does not have that image of God. They say God is love, but they have an image of God as controlling everything. And they're side by side. And you feel like saying, get your brain together, for God's sake. Block one ear and shove it in from the other side so that you've got to have it consistent. If God is love, God is not controlling. So don't blame God when things go wrong. Don't blame anybody, really. But if you want to see the reasons, you better look at people who are not listening to God. I'm not listening to God. We're not listening to God. God isn't, just as God didn't organise the crucifixion, Pilate and the high priest and the crowd and whoever did, you know, they did it. You didn't do it either, just for the relax. But you might be crucifying somebody now in the body of Christ that we need to look at. But you didn't crucify Jesus because you weren't there. So that was all arranged by sinful human beings. God is love. So we're going to have to take that right through to the end, that insight, and keep it strong. In other words, he respects freedom, and he respects the freedom of the universe. So he doesn't organise earthquakes, volcanoes. So what you're doing when you're praying for a volcano to stop, I don't know, but go for it. I mean, we're allowed to be children, but I honestly don't know what you're doing, because the fact that I don't know doesn't mean a thing, but I honestly tell you I don't know. So I'll pray for something else while you pray for that. Or I'll go down underneath and get under a table and try and protect myself from it while you're sitting on top of the roof with glass pouring everywhere praying to God to stop the volcano. Okay, whatever. So, we should behave as ministers of divine providence. And personal conversion of heart is basic. But if it's true, if you and I are on an inner journey where we're purifying our hearts or allowing love to purify our hearts, you can't do that without being impelled to do something about politics and society and justice and wages. And I've got another thing here I could show you, and just got it ordered the other day for our Justice Committee, a clean start for the property services industry. It's quite a marvellous little thing. And people working in security and cleaning are just being driven to the wall by the whole this industrial relations and stuff, and they keep spruiking this absolute garbage about the fact that it's not, you know, it's helping everybody. Well, just this is worth a read, and it's got real people and their real lives and what they're doing, and well, they're being pushed to the wall, and there are two people cleaning, and then suddenly one of them gets sick. So there's one person cleaning, they're supposed to finish the lot, it goes over time, they don't get any more, it goes on, and they're getting $10 an hour. And they've got to get three jobs to keep, whatever, it goes on and on and on and on and on, and it's all ugly and dreadful. And I've got to do something about it. So have you. We've got to rage against it. So if there's going to be personal conversion of heart, since community is primary, it's all self-interest too. If the community is impoverished, I'm impoverished. Aren't you? If the chook yard is fouled, well, it's not going to help me. And if the air is polluted and I'm a migratory bird and I'm sucking in all this junk, or if the Enron, I keep forgetting the name, but breaks its thing and spreads sludge all over the ocean up in Alaska, and I'm a seabird, well, I can't fly. Well, you can't fly. We all, so we've got to, even just sheerly, well, for truth, we've got to do something about it. Well, that's the point that I guess I'm making there. And to conclude the introduction, the Synod of Bishops in 1971, that's in Rome, all the bishops came together. It was called Justice in the World, and in the introduction this statement occurs: action on behalf of justice and participation in the transformation of the world fully appear to us as a constitutive dimension. You can't do without it, in other words, as an essential part of the preaching of the gospel. So the kind of preaching that you might get if you flick on to, I haven't done it for years, so pardon me if I'm out of date, if you might flick onto a station early in the morning when you've got nothing to do, God knows why you'd go to the television, but anyhow, you might, and you get somebody spruiking from some glass bloody palace church in, usually in the States, I have to tell you, but it could be here. If we had more money, we'd be doing it here too. And they're talking about Christianity, and it's all success Christianity. Nothing to do with justice, nothing to do with the poor, nothing to do with I was hungry and you gave me to eat, I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. Nothing. All about being right with God and successful and individual and the rest of it. Well, you're as sick of it as I am, I know. But that's given out as Christianity. No. Essential to the preaching of the gospel is the life of Jesus and the God revealed there on Calvary. It has nothing to do with success in any sense except the success, if we could use the word, of becoming a human being who's fully alive and beautifully creative in love. That's the only thing. In other words, that was me then, but back to the document. In other words, of the church's mission for the redemption of the human race and its liberation from every oppressive situation. The second section of the catechism treatment is about our participation in social life, and it has a comment on authority. So I'm just going to make my comments on that now, and that's... let's look at the word first. It comes from the word author, obviously, authority, and author comes from the Latin auctor, same word in English, and that comes from the verb augere or augere, depending on what Latin you pronounce. And augere, augment, you've got it in augment, it means to cause something to grow. Augment, to cause it to grow. So an author is someone who enables growth. We've all got authority, and if the authority is used genuinely, it's enabling those for whom we exercise that authority to actually grow. For the proper exercise of authority, one must be in communion with the author of being, namely God. One must have something to say, and one must understand and respect the listeners so that what one says helps something grow in them. So proper authority obviously requires listening, connection, reality testing, being in touch with the people whom you want to grow because you want them to grow. If you've got a plant that needs sun, well, you put it in the sun. If it needs shade, you put it in the shade. If it needs a lot of water, you give it a lot of water. If it needs a little bit of water, you need a little bit of water. And any of you who've had more than one child know exactly what I'm talking about. They're all so unique that you just have to somehow do your best as wisely as you can. And that's what everyone has to do, including parish priests. You've got to meet people where they are and get them to know them and help them grow. That's the proper use of authority. All authority in the church is an expression of the authority of Jesus, God's Word made flesh. Every baptized person shares in this authority. Everyone has authority. We're all here to help others grow. We all have something to say and to do to help others grow. So there's the word authority, taken back to its roots and I think accurately expressing what it means. Now, here we come to this. It's an abuse of authority to use force to get others to comply. That is getting you to do what I want you to do, and I have the power to enforce it. That's not authority. It's got another name. Because you're not growing, I'm just getting more power over you and causing you to submit. So now I want to do something that's a bit strange to do, but it's very, I think, in the church today, I find it really important, so I'll offer it to you. It's a psychological look at people who have an authoritarian personality. It's one of the known types of psychology, and I'll be watching you all carefully. If any of you blush, I'll know that that's beautiful. You're recognizing that you've got this, but you'll all be thinking of other people who have it, because so will I be, because I've met people with this authoritarian personality. But it's worth looking at because it helps us understand what we're dealing with. So let's look at it. You make your own judgment. I think it's an excellent statement. The authoritarian personality, the concern of someone with this temperament is to preserve a system of authoritarian order in which their security is maintained by buttressing and idealizing those in authority. In the church, it'll generally be the Pope. Until the Pope says something that the people don't like, and then they say he's a communist plot, or something like Paul VI wasn't really Paul VI. You know, people will go to extremes to preserve their psychological security with this temperament, with this personality. So they seem to be defending the church, and they might appear in their own eyes, they will, to be conservative, conserving. But what's actually happening, I'm suggesting to you, or the people who wrote this are suggesting, they're actually conserving the rigid structures within which they feel secure. They're not actually preserving truth or the church's tradition or anything else. And I'm not knocking these people. I'm saying it's very good to know what's happening, lest we attack them, which of course only hardens them in their poverty and their insecurity, or lest we take notice of them, which would be bizarre, because we would be supporting a pretty sick situation. So one has to love people with this temperament, but not take notice of them. That's about my way of doing it anyhow. Because you know what it's coming from, and it's not helpful to listen or to... You listen, but you let it go through to the keeper a lot and somehow try to maintain some kind of balance. So I hope it's becoming clear, but it'll become clear with the second one. People of this in the church with this temperament, and I have to tell you I've known people in this quite significantly all my priestly life. For my own self-knowledge, I don't think I have this temperament. If you think I have, talk to me privately later. But I don't think I have, and I know a lot of people without it. But if you do anything in the church in a public way, you're under attack by people with this kind of temperament. They claim to be defending the church or the Pope, but unconsciously, their real concern is not the truth of the matter, but their own psychological and social survival, which is maintained by ensuring that the authority preserves an order of clarity and safety in which they can participate because they're fearful of uncertainty. Very understandable in a changing world. Their emptiness is filled by blind obedience to authority. And if this or the institution from which it emanates is questioned, their source of strength and meaning is endangered, and their emptiness threatens to overwhelm them. So we need a lot of compassion for people like this. But as I say again, we need to know what we're dealing with and where they're coming from, lest we act poorly to the detriment of the common good by going along with them, because they can be very rigorous and very strong and very determined, and we need to know the psychological profile that we're dealing with. To continue, and there's only one more page on this, when they attack the one they consider a heretic, and they'll always have a name for it, a modernist, whatever God forsake us that is, I'd hate to be a non-modernist, but a modernist, or, and you'll get whatever name you get. And I have to tell you, I'm talking as an expert. For a year, I was the modernist of the modern world. There's a book got out called Fidelity, still a little pamphlet, it's still produced in Melbourne by this lot. Fidelity, for God's sake. They lie about what you've said, they get it all mixed up, they're defending things, they quote people out of context. It's just, I don't know if it's got any better, I don't bother with it now, but 20 years ago it was a scurrilous rag, but by people of very high moral positions, truly, who had no concern for the truth or love. And they kept attacking everybody I love, they kept attacking me. I didn't defend myself in their view because I think that's not the way to go. If others want to defend me, let them go for it. But I refuse to give it any credence, because I think the way I took it. But when they attack this one, they're propelled by fear, because they're fearful that this institution within which they get their security, this cage that they're living in, is someone's opened the door of the cage and you might have to fly. Do you know what I mean? I'm sounding very hard, but I think loving is the only way through, but not taking notice of this, what's going on. We've got to see what it is. In the process, they act with little or no respect for truth. That's been my experience. No, little or no respect for justice or fidelity to the ideas of those they attack. Their aim is to eliminate by any means that which they perceive as a threat. I think I read to you on an earlier occasion Thomas Groom and the attack on him that he had to defend himself in our Australian Compass was the article, fine article. He went to all this trouble to defend himself against a New South Wales high school teacher who was attacking him and was being quoted by everyone as an authority. And it was rubbish. He went and proved that what they were saying was not true. So the high school teacher must have been defending his security. But to do that without regard for the truth is appalling. Opposing them, this is my hint for you if ever you're getting yourself into this situation, feeds their insecurity and hardens their attack. It's been my experience anyhow that the best way to treat this is to be straight, honest, clear, truthful, caring, and take no notice of what's going on. Because that way you come through it and they get tired of you not opposing them, or because they love a fight. Attempting to appease them by acting in ways that they want, and by the way, this happens in all kinds of situations. I've experienced it. You get archbishops and you say, well, the archbishop doesn't want this. Some little monsignor somewhere says the archbishop doesn't want it. Does the archbishop not want it? For example, I was in Rome. The Ursulines were going to have their meeting with John Paul II, who can be pretty strong. And they're told by everybody at the Vatican, oh, you'll have to all get into the old vestments. They're not vestments, what do you call them? Habit. With the this and that and the thing here and the thing there and the kind of, you know, and so you better do all that. And they just said, we're not going to do it. This is the way we dress normally. We're going as we are. So they went as they are, and the Pope was lovely with them. Obliging with them, met them, shook their hands, praised them for the wonderful work they did, and out they go. So the Pope wasn't the problem. It was all the people who were protecting the system that were the problem. Do you get me? And that's not only there, that'll happen everywhere. So somehow we've got to keep our own integrity, be yourself, and trust that it's going to work and not take notice of anything. Sounds like I'm an authoritarian personality, doesn't it? Okay. So attempting to appease them, by the way, is fatal to the building of a healthy community, because it's not in accordance with the truth. That's the end of that little thing. But what is in accordance with the truth is so hard, but you'd know that from your own life, and I know it from my life as a parish priest. You have to listen to everyone, but there are certain people you can't take notice of. You just have to be gentle and kind with them, and after a while they might find out that you're doing nothing at all about what they're saying, and then they have to cope with that. But it takes a while, I think, for them to find out. And if you're gentle with them and listen to them, maybe they forget what they said. I don't know how it works. But you've got to build community, haven't you? And you couldn't do something untruthful to please someone that's going to hurt everybody else. On the subject then of going back to authority, now that's all on the web already if you want to look at it and think about it more. Here's Paul writing to Rome, 56 AD, so he's writing to, he's in Corinth, he's going into Jerusalem where he's going to be accused by the Judaizing group. And he's going to have a hard time there. And they're very, Rome and Jerusalem were very close. The community in Rome was largely Jewish. There may have been some Gentiles in it, but it was largely Jewish. And very close relationship with Jerusalem. So his reputation wouldn't be too good in Rome. So he's writing ahead to Rome to give his theology straight out so they can get what he's talking about. And he does it so carefully in one of his most wonderful letters, the Letter to the Romans. It's a thesis about his gospel, what he teaches. And he's also got it in mind when he goes to Jerusalem. And he says this as part of it. Remember, we're talking about 56 AD. In 60, the 66, 10 years later, there'll be the big blow-up, the Roman-Jewish war that goes on for 7 years. Jerusalem is destroyed. So there's simmering discontent among the Jews against Rome, understandably. But the Roman Christian Jews, it was very hard for them to not get involved in the knifing and the anti-Roman stuff. So they had to tread a very careful path here. So this is what Paul's advice to them was. I think it's good advice. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. There's no authority except from God. And those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed. I can see already by your look, this has to be understood carefully. Yeah, it does. And those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Authority is God's servant for your good. Well, if you read that carefully, my comment is, on the generous assumption that those exercising authority are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad, Paul is urging the community in Rome not to join in anti-government activity. So, in principle, we're not anti-government. In principle. Because government, in principle, is there for the good of the people and so on. So we don't just start humbly, we start respectfully. But of course, if the government is not favouring good conduct but bad, as Paul will learn himself and would have known from the beginning, they will resist it. And the Roman Church was persecuted for it by Nero and the rest of them. So one has to say no to authority. One doesn't obey it automatically. But you see the point he's making. Don't join an anti-government movement just because it's there. Your first assumption is to listen, to obey, to play your role in society and so on. Civil authority has a place in divine providence, and when civil authority is exercised in accordance with God's will, it is to be honoured. First letter of Peter, to the best of my study, I think Peter did write it, and I think it comes from the middle 60s, so about 10 years after Paul had written to the Romans. He writes, "For the Lord's sake, accept the authority of every human institution, whether of the emperor as supreme or of governors, as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and praise those who do right." Very similarly, it's on the assumption that the government is honest and doing its job properly, because we have obligations. And Thomas Aquinas makes a very good point here in his Summa. He says, "A human law has the character of law to the extent that it accords with right reason and thus derives from the eternal law. Insofar as it falls short of right reason, it is said to be an unjust law and thus has not so much the nature of law as of a kind of violence." So he makes a very clear distinction between reasonable law in society and violence, state violence against the people in the community or whatever. So that's the end of that little bit of all I want to say about authority. And then just the headings now. The Article 2 talks about participation in social life and talks about the common good, which I have no comment on. It reads very simply in the Catechism. Respect for persons, their fundamental and inalienable rights. Concern for social well-being and developments of community. Concern for peace, stability and security of social, of good order. And the Catechism says the common good is to be founded on truth, based on justice and animated by love. The third section I want to look at with you is on social justice. Justice in society. Everyone enjoys, says the Catechism, an equal dignity. I personally find the word equal very difficult in this context. I think I know what they're saying, and I'm sure you do. Equal is a mathematical term that isn't very helpful to me. I think there's a better way of putting it, and I'm not sure how to do it. It's like saying you give equal care to a rose or to a violet or to a lily. Well, you don't really. You treat a rose as a rose, and that's perhaps what it's trying to get at, or maybe it's getting at it better than I am. You give the appropriate care. So a piano is not equal to an organ, but you have to give, I suppose, equal care, but it's not equal. Do you get what I'm trying? I got a problem with the word equal. You have to give loving, appropriate care to each person and each institution according to its nature and what it's capable of. Something like that. Every form of social or cultural discrimination is in fundamental personal rights on the grounds of sex, race, colour, social conditions, language or religion must be curbed and eradicated as incompatible with God's design. Again, we've got problem words there. Discrimination is exactly what we should be doing, in my view. But it's not a nice word. It's not politically correct. To discriminate means to make a judgment discerning how things are different. That's what discrimination technically means. So maybe our language has just been pulled right back to we've forgotten it. To discriminate between one and another, using the words in their absolutely careful way, is to discern that this is this and that is that, and they both need different care. But I understand what's happened to our language. It's come to mean to discriminate means to ignore one, doesn't it, and favour the other, or to something like that. So let's not quibble over words for a minute. Somehow or other, we cannot judge badly or ignore a person because of that person's sex, race, colour, social condition, language or religion. We have to respect, honour, insofar as there's truth involved, all of these differences. You make your own words better than I can. Vatican II says, their equal dignity as persons demands that we strive for fairer and more humane conditions. Excessive economic and social disparity between individuals and peoples of the one human race is a source of scandal and militates against social justice, equity, human dignity, as well as social and international peace. These are kind of motherhood statements, but they do need meditating on and discerning and getting the implications of them. I'm just offering them to you so you know where to go to find them again. John the 23rd. It's not enough to acknowledge and respect everyone's right to the means of sustenance if we do not strive to the best of our ability for a sufficient supply of what is necessary for this sustenance. The basic understanding on this is that God is just. And by just we mean what? We mean God always acts according to who God is. That's the biblical understanding of justice. It's to be who you are and to act as you are. Justice. So the king to be just is very different from the high priest to be just, or the farmer to be just, or the wife to be just, or the children. To be just means be who you are in the context of the society and act according to your obligations, your position, and so on. Well, God is love, so God's justice is God's fidelity to love. God will always act according to how God is. Here's a quote from Lamentations. The favours of Yahweh are not all past. His kindnesses are not exhausted. Every morning they are renewed. Great is God's faithfulness. That's our underlying. So always judges. God always judges according to how things are. And Jesus asks us, be perfect as your Father is perfect. Not meaning degree. We're not talking about that. That's a bit stupid and impossible. How can you measure the infinite and the finite? It means the kind of perfection that Jesus wants us to live is the kind of perfection that we see in God, which is a perfection of love, justice, love. The Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference in 1996 got out a pastoral statement called A New Beginning, Eradicating Poverty in Our World. And it defined poverty according to these different levels. And that's simple, but good meditation, I think. Economic, which is what we often think of, a low level of income and wealth. Socio-political poverty. The inability to access satisfactorily services such as education, health and social welfare. These are worth a lot of reflection. That's another level of poverty. Political poverty. Not being able to participate actively in the decisions that affect one's life. There'd be many who'd argue that we're not really in a democracy at all. I mean, we do have an election whenever the government wants us to have one, and that seems like an exercise of, and it is, it's better than not having it. So we've got the power to get rid of a government and put it in, if we're thinking at the time. But what say do any of us have in real sense of what kind of democratic awareness is being awakened when the newspapers are getting into fewer and fewer hands and all that stuff? What kind of education are we getting? How often do we go onto the streets and express ourselves and so on? So it's worth thinking about anyhow. Cultural poverty. The reality of marginalisation. Living at the edge of mainstream society. spiritual poverty. Not in the religious sense. In the religious sense, that's beautiful. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Means those who are totally dependent on God recognize that and are listening and attentive to the movement of the Spirit of God in their lives. That's beautiful. That's the poverty of a child. Now, spiritual poverty here means poverty of their spirit. The experience of rejection, loss of hope and energy, despair, resignation. It might be something that affects a lot of Aboriginal communities very gravely because they've lost their bearings. Or first generation migrants coming out of the rich... I don't know how Italians come here. Italy's a place I know. The first generation of Italians coming out of those piazzas where they're sitting and talking and chatting and there's shady and there's a lovely mountain in the back and they've got their history behind them and they've got a lovely church and they've got a fountain there and they've got everything been going on for centuries, and they come out here and get stuck out in Western Sydney or wherever and nobody talks to you and there's fences and there's no piazza and there's no talking, and they come to church and there's no coffee shop outside to just sit around and talk. Some stick around, some get into their car and drive off. And so actually we should build shouldn't we? We should have a piazza there built there with a coffee shop. Would anyone like to run a coffee shop in our church? I mean, make some money out of it too. But whatever, I'm just saying the cultural poverty must be quite immense, and the spiritual poverty for people. And they do it for the betterment of their children. Then their children lose touch with their culture and they end up not going to mass anyhow. And the poor parents don't know what's going on. And they came out so their children would be free, and their child ends up on drugs or something. So they must break. Anyhow, we'll all be weeping if I keep going. Must be breaking their heart. They go on to say, to eradicate poverty, we must focus on the way in which both society and the economy are organised. And don't be too naive about it. To eradicate means to root out, to deal with the deepest causes. In the case of poverty, these are structural in nature, related to the way society is organized. We need to get into that. The alleviation of poverty is, however, also a very significant and important action, since it seeks to reduce the level of personal suffering associated with poverty. What is needed is both social, political and economic change to address the causes of poverty and the more traditional welfare activities associated with welfare and charitable institutions to address the consequences or symptoms of poverty. That's a clear distinction, isn't it? The work of alleviation needs to be done in the light of the work of eradication. In the best programs, both dimensions are present. So we have the Vincent de Paul working to care for, of course, and we all part of that. But we also have people who are looking at the causes of this and dealing with them on the political and public and systemic area. And we've all got a responsibility there as well. And I'll conclude before you take a break. This is the Puebla document, got out by the Central American, Selam, what's that? Latin American Episcopal Conference. And it says, the faces of young children struck down by poverty before they're born, the faces of young people disoriented because they cannot find their place in society and are frustrated by the lack of opportunity to find work, the faces of indigenous people living marginalized lives in inhuman situations, the faces of the unemployed and the underemployed subject to cold economic calculations, the faces of old people frequently marginalized in a progress-oriented society. Just to put an image on what we're trying to talk about now. One of the terms that has come up a lot in the last 20 or so years is this sometimes called preferential option for the poor. When we're making decisions, we start thinking of the poor before we start thinking of something else. So it's the angle from which you come at things. The option for the poor, this is a remark made by the Australian bishops in that same document in 1996. The option for the poor is a decision for humility and for sharing of power. It requires standing alongside poor and oppressed people and viewing the world through their eyes. It involves a commitment to work with poor people for the eradication of poverty in a spirit of service, not domination. It means allowing the poor to play the primary role in the struggle. It also means accepting, in a way that is not guilt-ridden but calmly and with courage, the way in which those of us who are not poor are caught up in the social systems which allow poverty to continue. Won't comment on it. I think it's very amply clear, but it is worth reflection when you look at it later and ponder what it might mean for our lives. The Pontifical Commission for Justice and Peace, in its summary, which I showed you earlier, it's a statement made in 1975, says, "The Church must preach more forcefully and realise more effectively liberation of the poor, of the oppressed and the outcast. The Church must work with others to build a world where every person, no matter what race, religion or nationality, can live a fully human life free from servitude." Albert Nolan, Dominican, in his gives a very good definition of what it means, the option for the poor. This is a statement he made in 1986. See what you think of it. Just the option for the poor is an uncompromising and unequivocal taking of sides in a situation of structural conflict. It's not a matter of preaching to some people rather than to others. Brackets. Jesus offered love to everybody. The rich young man, Pilate, Herod. We're not limiting the mission. Close brackets. So it's not a matter of preaching to some people rather than others, or a matter of being generous to the underprivileged. It's not a matter of a judgment about the personal guilt of the rich, or even, in the first instance, it's not a matter of lifestyle. It's an assertion that Christian faith entails for everyone, and as part of its essence, the taking of sides in a structural conflict between the oppressor and the oppressed. Just a little personal comment. It was when I went, because I lived a very sheltered life for nearly all my life, when I went to the University of New South Wales in 1972 as chaplain, so what am I? I'm 35. That was the first time some of this became clear to me, because I always had general principles, and, for example, the Vietnam War was going on and a million other things. And the question comes up, do you demonstrate or you do not demonstrate? I mean, what do you do? What role do you take? And, of course, if you decide, which I decided, to demonstrate, you find yourself walking beside every other rat bag in the world. I mean, they have opinions that I haven't got, but they've got this in common, that they want to defend the Aboriginal cause, or they want justice for the Union, or they want against the Vietnam War. But you're necessarily walking with people of a whole range of diversity of opinions, and there could be the risk that people could think you're agreeing with all them on other issues. Do you get me? The alternative is to sit back, which was my first wondering position, didn't last long, I have to tell you, and think, well, but if I only demonstrate with the people whom I entirely agree with, I'd be on my own. So I remember quite quickly being helped to by different people at the university, some of whose faces have flashed into my mind, to realise that you have to take the side of the oppressed in any particular issue. So you start there. And if you find yourself with a whole lot of people that you don't agree with, well, that's so what? If you don't demonstrate or take a stand, you are now with a whole lot of people with whom you don't agree. Do you know? Either way, silence or talk, action or inaction, you're taking sides. And to do nothing is to take the side of the oppressed. I'm sure of that. So it forced me into a position which I, don't know, did. But it was a conversion experience for me too, and a realisation experience, let's put it that way. And he puts it quite nicely there. It continues, this is again Albert Nolan, a thoroughgoing option for the poor includes the willingness to question one's assumptions and to learn from those who are oppressed. It's only after one has learned to have confidence in the ability of the oppressed to promote their own cause and to bring about their own liberation that one can begin to share the struggle with them and to make a contribution in real solidarity with all those who have taken an option against oppression. I also found this comment very helpful for myself, and I hope you will for you. It's that lovely Abbé Pierre in France. Some say the most popular priest in France, because he worked with the poor. And in 1957, he wrote a rule for the Companions of Emmaus that he was working with to care for the street children and all the poverty after the Second World War, really. And I find this dramatic, powerful, unlivable, but worth keeping in mind, and maybe it is livable if we're heroic. He says this: let us never lose our living conviction that it's not necessary to wait until we're splendid people before we do splendid things. That would probably mean waiting for a long time. Too long, in fact. We need only to understand one splendid thing and then try to base our whole life on it. And that thing is that the person we must help in all things is the person who's suffering the most. That's daunting in its simplicity, isn't it? But worth echoing and depthing, and well, that's what he did. The Australian bishops, again, just a general thing, I'll just read it, I won't comment on it, I'll just read it so you know it's there and want to go back to it. In that same pastoral of 1996, talking about the structures of poverty, lists the following: concentration of power in the hands of relatively small groups. That's growing since they wrote that. Unemployment. Low wages for some forms of full-time work and insufficient income support for those not in full-time paid employment. Inadequate access or discrimination in obtaining such access to services and resources such as health, education, energy, water, information and transport. Unjust trade relations between rich and poor countries. The effect of European colonialism on poor countries. The oppression of women and children. The operation of totally state-controlled economies and societies, stifling freedom and creativity. Or the unrestrained operation of capitalist economies, which idolise profit, competition and the ownership of the means of production. Wars, widespread conflicts, racism, discrimination, the violation of human rights, ecological damage due either to lack of information or to economic need. So there's a list for meditation there, and you probably could add to it, though it's a pretty exhaustive list. I'll now move on to a meditation with you, that's all, from the scripture and then from some of the early fathers of the church. And just for your prayer, really, to show you this concern for social justice as part of our spiritual and religious tradition that Jesus picked up and made beautifully real. Here we have Exodus chapter 22. You shall not wrong or oppress a resident alien. You are aliens in the land of Egypt. You shall not abuse a widow or orphan. If you do abuse them when they cry out to me, I will surely heed their cry. My wrath will burn. If you lend money to the poor among you, you shall not exact interest from them. If you take your neighbor's cloak in as a pawn, you shall restore it before the sun goes down. Exodus 22, one of the oldest strands of the Bible. The prophet Amos, the earliest of the prophets whose prophecy we have in writing. Thus says the Lord, I will not revoke my punishment on Israel because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of their way. In the house of God, they drink wine bought with fines which they imposed. Isaiah chapter 5. O you who join house to house, who add field to field till there's no room for anyone but you, and you're left to live alone in the midst of the land. Isaiah 10. You who make iniquitous decrees, who write oppressive statutes, to turn aside the needy from justice, and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be your spoil, that you may make the orphans your prey. Isaiah 58. Is not this the fast that I choose, says the Lord, to loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover them and not hide yourself from your own kin? Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You'll cry for help, and he will say, Here I am. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places. He'll make your bones strong. You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. Jeremiah chapter 22. Woe to the one who builds his house by injustice, his upper rooms by unrighteousness, who makes his neighbor work for nothing and does not give them their wages, who says, I will build myself a spacious house with large upper rooms, and who cuts out windows for it, paneling it with cedar and painting it with vermilion. Are you a king because you compete in cedar? Did not your father, this is being addressed to Josiah was the father. This is the son of Josiah that he's referring to. He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well. Is not this to know me, says Yahweh. But your eyes and your heart are only on dishonest gain, for shedding innocent blood and for practicing oppression and violence. And I'll conclude with Deuteronomy chapter 17. All of this Jesus would have read as a young man. Everyone would have read it, but it went over the heads of most. It didn't go over the head of Jesus. He absorbed it and tasted it and learned to commit himself to it. And of course, it's beautifully expressed in the gospel. But the last of the Jewish texts I'll read for you, Deuteronomy 17. The king must not acquire many horses for himself, or return the people to Egypt in order to acquire more horses. Since Yahweh said to you, you must never return that way again. Horses are the equivalent of our tanks, you know, they were the military weapon. He must not acquire many wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Silver and gold he must not acquire in great quantity for himself. When he has taken the throne of his kingdom, this is the king, he shall have a copy of this law written for him in the presence of the Levitical priests. Copy of this law in Greek is Deuteronomos. That's where it gets the name from, Deuteronomy, a copy of the law. It shall remain with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God, diligently observing all the words of this law and these statutes, neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandment either to the right or the left. So even the highest political authority in the land, the king, was subject to the Torah. It wasn't a monarchy. And now just a few statements from the early fathers of the church, which are really quite, well, they'll stir you up a bit as they do me. And it's just nice to hear them, what they said, or nice, it's... St. Basil, writing in the middle of the 4th century. When someone steals another person's clothes, we call that person a thief. Should we not give the same name to one who could clothe the naked and does not? The bread in your cupboard belongs to the person who is hungry. The coat hanging unused in your wardrobe belongs to the person who needs it. The shoes rotting there belong to the one who has no shoes. The money you are hoarding belongs to the poor. Unless you think he was alone in this way of looking at things, St. Jerome, writing a little bit later, about the year 400, writes, he's quoting Luke chapter 16, Luke very rightly spoke of money of injustice. For all riches come from injustice. Unless one person has lost, another cannot find. Therefore, I believe that the popular proverb is very true. The rich person is either an unjust person or the heir of one. Not everyone would fancy agreeing with St. Jerome. Well, let's try St. John Chrysostom. A contemporary, in his sermon, he says this, and I conclude with this for your better comfort. Tell me, says St. John Chrysostom, how did you come by your wealth? Did you receive it from someone? From where did he get it? From your grandfather or father? Are you able to show, as you go back through the generations, that it was justly acquired? It cannot have been. No, the beginning and root of wealth must lie in injustice of some sort. Why? because in the beginning God did not create one person wealthy and another to go wanting. God gave one and the same earth to all alike. And inasmuch as the earth is a common possession, how is it that you have acres and acres of land while your neighbour has not the tiniest fraction of the earth? Even if your wealth has been gathered honestly, is wealth something good? Not at all, says John. Nor is it something evil, so long as it's not hoarded and is shared out with those in need. Unshared, wealth becomes something evil, a trap. Is it not evil that you claim sole ownership of what belongs to the Lord, of what is common property? Or do you deny that the Lord's is the earth and its fullness? Whatever belongs to the Lord belongs equally to all. Strife comes only when someone tries to gain possession of something and make it his own. It is as if human nature itself grows angry when, in spite of God's uniting us in every way, we are bent on dividing and standing apart by owning things and using phrases like, "This belongs to me," or "That is yours." Chilling words indeed. Whatever is necessary for life is given to all alike. Yet even in the smallest matters, we cannot seem to keep things common to all. God has made his great gifts available to all in common so that we might learn to share lesser things. But we haven't learned this lesson. How then can a rich person be good? By giving his wealth to others, and so by being no longer wealthy. As long as he hoards it for himself, he cannot be good. We'd all be expert in qualifying those statements. I just offer them to you for your reflection, meditation, and conversion, and for my own, and for my own. And maybe next week you'll have all kinds of interesting questions about them that I won't be able to answer. So just let me